Peter Hap. Hi. Johan.
I'm here.
Mom and Kathy.
Kathy's here.
John Hannigan. Dan Savage. Dale and Bill.
Bill is here. Dale is on vacation.
Dale is on vacation. Ken Warren. Okay. All right, so Michael Charnas. Ken Jones. Peter Hammond. Deepak. John Hannigan. Anyone who I didn't call?
Ed, it's Michael. I just joined.
Hey, Michael.
How are you?
I'm good. You getting
good.
All ready? You're going to Esbra?
I am going to Esbra.
Okay. All right, so Ken Jones, Peter Hammond, Deepak, Hannigan, Dan Savage is unlikely until later. All right, well, we can start. First of all, I'd like to... Kirsty, are you on there?
Yes. Yep, here I am.
Did I call you? All right, I'm sorry.
Hi, Jill. I'm getting a lot of feedback from someone, and I can't tell who it is with the new system. If someone's, like, in a cafeteria, can you...
Hello?
That's better.
That better? All right. Okay, well, the first thing I'd like to do is to welcome Sarah Jo, who's now, since we changed the conference call time, can make these calls, and she's the newest member of our Science Advisory Board. I'd also like to welcome Joanne Weinberg and Christy Donald, who are the two new developmental projects that are joining CFAS. We are still awaiting State Department approval of Joanne's project, but it's approved this morning, I guess. I got an email from Bill about that. So.
Oh, great.
So, Christy, you are all set to go, and Joanne, you should be set shortly. It just takes a little bit of time, and my research office was not on top of things. So,
okay, no problem.
All right.
No problem.
All right. So they're going to be presenting a WebEx today, both Joanne and Christy, or Kirsty, I'm sorry. I should know that by now, about the projects they're going to be performing within CFAS, and people can quite integrate with what we have going on. Someone just joined?
Yeah, it was Ken. Ed, I'm sorry I'm late.
Hey, Ken. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. All right, so the only ones, Peter, Deepak, John Hannigan, and Dan Savage.
I'm here. Peter, I'm here.
Hey, Peter. Okay, Deepak, John Hannigan. All right. The first thing I want to do is I want to thank everybody for getting me those progress reports relative to their specific aims that were outlined in CFAS 3. I sent those out to the Science Advisory Board and NIAAA last night. Jill did that. And so just wanted to, a lot of you did and much more than I really wanted you to spend time-wise in putting those together. But we thought we needed a update on deliverables toward the aims that people had proposed 4 years ago and where we were and how much progress was being made in each of those. And a few things came to light. in those, but I'm going to let the Science Advisory Board and NIAAA peruse them. But the first thing is that some people are not using the concept proposal sheet that they have available to them, since they list publications as being in progress, but we don't have any record of them. So if you are one of those offending people, could you please complete the concept proposal form? Jill, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, just a reminder, there's like four different forms for whatever stage your publication is, but it starts with a concept so that other people can get involved with it.
So we would appreciate it if people would keep those up to date. As these progress reports are reviewed, then we will get individual feedback to you about where the SAB believes your project is relative to what was proposed, and whether the aims are being met, and whether there is a real product that's been delivered from in trying to address each of those aims. Because in talking to some reviewers, I think that that's one of the things that people are going to be looking at, is we proposed this, what did we accomplish in addressing that specific aim? And so that's why we needed these. And now that Joanne's part of CFAS and can't review for us anymore, we're going to get really, really tough reviewers. Not that Joanne wasn't tough, but I'm trying to make funny, but I'm not doing it.
I got it. Tough in the nicest possible way.
Yeah. Well, all right. Just a few updates. Helen is on with you, Bill, I'm hoping, and can tell us about the cross-query tool update.
Yeah, she is.
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
So how is that tool coming? Because that's one of the items we said we would have completed, and we're late into the project, and we really need that up and running.
I think we completed it because it doesn't seem like we have any issues at the moment. The last time we met, we identified actually a bug in Oracle, and we have a new person that is a DBA in our team that's working for Oracle, and elevated that issue to the Oracle support, and the issue was resolved quite quickly, like in 2 days. So at this point, I would like to encourage everyone to start using it and treat it as a work in progress. So if you see any possibilities to improve it, please do not hesitate to send me a request or send a ticket to our ticketing system. It would be easier for us to track the request, but please don't hesitate just to tell me if you see that something needs to be improved.
Okay. Have people been trying to access that and using it and utilizing it? Sarah, it's Elizabeth.
Deanne, this is Sarah. I tried to use it after our last call before I went on vacation, and to be perfectly honest, I have not gone back to it since I got back, but I wasn't able to successfully use it. So I'm hoping that what Helen is saying now, that the issues that I identified have been addressed, but again, I have not gone back to look at it again.
Yeah, I think, Sarah, thank you very much. You know, it was exactly the issue that you identified was addressed during that work, and I think that the last time it was used in August 14th.
Okay. All righty, so I would encourage people, if they want to access multidisciplinary data, that they are now able to do that. And to
can I just ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Sorry, I know you want to move on, but so the is the dysmorphology data now? Because I think that was one of the sticking points, because it's complex. That was where it kept falling down. So, Helen, has that been addressed?
Yes, it was actually not the problem was not with my code, it was with the amount of data, and for some reason Oracle just kept, you know, heating up. If you remember, you know, if you would like to check the all data in the data sets of the checkbox, then it was kind of throwing up the errors. So that issue was resolved, and I tried it out. It works quite fine, but please don't hesitate to use it and see, you know, if anything else would pop up.
Okay, so, thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we'll move on to the WebExes so that people can get an idea of the two new developmental projects. And Jill, do you have a schedule for who's going first? Or
nope.
Joanne, you want to kick it off?
Sure. So I'll try to share my screen.
I think everybody knows Joanne, so she needs no introduction.
Can everyone see the slide?
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, hi, everybody. I'm really excited and happy to be part of CFest and today to have a chance to share the project with you. This is a collaborative project with Tina Chambers and the team, and you see the title there. I have on the title slide the two people from my lab who were very instrumental in developing the proposal, my research associate, Charlie Schreinecke, who's a co-investigator on the project, and Tammy Bodner, who's currently a PhD student, and she'll be transitioning to a postdoc and helping to lead the project as well. So just a quick little bit of background. We know that children with FASD show a wide range of deficits in immune function, higher incidence of infections, altered leukocyte cell counts and responsiveness to stimulation, and an increased incidence of some cancers, particularly lymphomas and leukemias. There's a fair amount of data from animal models that confirm and extend those findings, but despite this, this is still a relatively understudied area in the FASD field. So the current project really was inspired by our recent animal work on neuroimmune function, and there are two major findings that I'm going to illustrate very briefly from our animal project. So following an immune or inflammatory challenge, we found that prenatal alcohol-exposed, PAE, animals show more severe and more prolonged arthritis or inflammation. And secondly, that it appears that this exaggerated response has a basis in an early life profile, an early life pro-inflammatory bias that we see from birth to weaning. So just to illustrate this briefly, we have a standard animal model. Most of you are familiar with it, prenatal alcohol exposure. We have an ad libitum-fed control group and a pair-fed group to control for the reduced food intake that we see in the ethanol-consuming animals. And then we have been looking at the offspring, and in these initial studies, we focused more on female offspring because females are a little more susceptible to inflammatory alterations. So here is an illustration of the first finding we had. We used an adjuvant-induced arthritis model where females were injected at the base of the tail with either a stimulant that induces inflammation or with saline, and then we tracked the course of inflammation following injection. And here's what we saw, and we're going to continue this color scheme throughout. We saw that control animals in blue, labeled C, we are looking at incidence of arthritis or incidence of inflammation. And we can see that about 30% of controls develop inflammation, the inflammation persists for a period of time, and then resolves completely. Pair-fed animals in green show a much higher incidence of inflammation, of arthritis, but again, virtually all of them resolve over time. There's a slight delay in onset of inflammation in the prenatal alcohol-exposed animals, but 50% of them never resolve. And we've now repeated this and carried it out to 60 days, and still we see about half the animals never resolve. And when we look at severity of inflammation, that's also much greater in the alcohol-exposed animals. So then we asked, is there a developmental origin for this altered inflammatory response? And we looked at cytokine levels, the chemicals or hormones produced by cells of the immune system, very similar to hormones of the endocrine system. And we tracked the development of the cytokine profile in the plasma, in the spleen, and in the brain from birth to weaning age. And we asked, is there a change in the balance of pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines in early development? And here's what we found. Interestingly, from birth until weaning age, the alcohol-exposed animals shown in red have enlarged spleens compared to the two control groups. And we see that shown here at postnatal day 8, postnatal day 15, and at weaning postnatal day 22. And interestingly, on postnatal day 8, there was a direct positive correlation between maternal alcohol intake and spleen weight. We then looked at cytokines, and again, some of the most interesting findings were on postnatal day 8. And that's what I'm illustrating here. We found that prenatal alcohol exposure gives rise to a distinct tissue-specific immune signature. And we looked peripherally in the blood, what are the cytokine levels in blood, and then centrally in the brain, what happens in different brain areas. And again, we found a change in the balance between pro- and anti-inflammatory cytokines with overall a kind of pro-inflammatory bias. So we saw circulating cytokine levels. This is all illustrated just from postnatal day 8, but similar findings throughout. Increased pro-inflammatory cytokines, two of the cytokines in particular, interferon gamma and TNF-alpha, were elevated in alcohol-exposed animals. Increased pro-inflammatory cytokines in the blood, and then in the brain, increase in pro-inflammatory cytokines in the hippocampus, several cytokines are elevated, but in contrast, a suppression of pro-inflammatory cytokines in the hypothalamus, and then kind of a mixed response in the prefrontal cortex. So balance across different brain areas, pro-inflammatory, more suppression of pro-inflammatory in hypothalamus, and then kind of a mixed balance in the prefrontal cortex. So this suggests alterations in microglia, a change in the level of cytokines being produced by microglia and by cells in the periphery. So that was the basis of the CFAS proposal. It's not known whether children with FASD also show this pro-inflammatory profile. They might. Other early life experiences do change cytokine expression, and there's more and more evidence that altered inflammatory mechanisms could play a role in a variety of physical and mental health disorders, including cardiovascular disease and depression, as an example. So the goal of the CFAS proposal is to look for an immune signature in children with FASD that could be linked to maternal immune function. We've measured endocrine function in parallel. We are going to assess both plasma and salivary markers and ask, are there alcohol-specific changes in saliva that parallel those in blood and could be used as a proxy for changes in blood, because obviously blood is more difficult to obtain as a sample, and then look at whether their nutritional supplementation can modulate that inflammatory profile. And here's what is proposed. We propose to obtain samples from children in the Ukrainian cohort at 4 years of age. These children are now scheduled over the next year or two to come back for assessment, follow-up assessment. Our hope is to get at least 20 children per group, all exposed, unexposed, with or without the nutritional intervention. We're going to use a very sensitive platform, Mesoscale Discovery, to assess a panel of 30 different cytokines. And that enables us to look at networks of interacting cytokines and give us a much more nuanced picture of what's going on in terms of immune function beyond what's currently possible with just a single cytokine analysis. Even though there's some promising data now on IL-6, still we think that this kind of very large cytokine profile can give us a lot more information. We also will measure cortisol and a sensitive inflammatory marker, C-reactive protein. At the same time, we're going to look at samples from the moms of these kids collected during pregnancy at enrollment and at the 32-week follow-up. And actually, we're going to start with the maternal samples because those are readily available, and then pick up the kids as they come back for follow-up. Again, the same three measures, a large cytokine profile, cortisol, and CRP. And then we will also, from the kids, collect saliva from the full cohort of children. That's easy to collect. And Tina already has the kits and has brought them to the Ukraine, so that's kind of going to be in place when we're able to start. The material is there, and we've put together instruction sheets for collection and so on. There we can measure salivary cortisol and CRP as a mixed index of endocrine and immune function. So that's the proposal. We think it's quite likely that the immune deficits in children arise from combined effects of alcohol exposure, both direct and indirect effects of alcohol exposure on the children, maternal dysregulation in terms of endocrine and immune function. And therefore, the measures we're going to get, the maternal cortisol CRP ratio and cytokine profile, together with similar measures from the kids, should give us a fair amount of information on the health status of the moms and possible health outcomes or projected health outcomes of the children. This could provide a possible biomarker for early identification of individuals with FASD, and ultimately, possibly, a step toward development of specific immune-based treatments that could attenuate some of the deficits, because altered endocrine function, elevated stress hormone levels, dysregulated stress hormone system, and increased inflammation not only affect immune function, but have ramifications, as I said, for mental health and physical health, and for cognitive function, attention, self-regulation, and so on. So that is our project.
Thank you very, very much. I apologize. I was cut off in the middle of it and had to call back in.
Oh, sorry. I heard.
I only missed a few minutes, so I don't know what happened. But all's good. So thank you, Joanne. And just, I was at the APSAR meeting in Australia, in Sydney. And
right.
A woman there by the name of Karen Moritz.
Oh, yes.
She's also looking at some of the fetal programming type measures in an animal model. And she's reporting these fairly reasonable effects with periconceptual alcohol exposure. So I just wanted to make sure you were aware of those.
Not only am I aware, but I visited her in Australia. She was invited by Bill and Dale and me to participate in the fetal programming symposium, DOHAD, Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, that we did in Orlando. So she came to that, and she and I have connected in a very major way. We're hoping to work with Bill and Dale to write a kind of piece on DOHAD in FASD, the idea of developmental origins in health and disease in FASD. And I visited her lab and gave a talk at her university, and she and I are going to try to connect and collaborate somehow. So she's absolutely terrific.
Yeah, and I think this idea that, you know, she's, I mean, I think the title of her talk was something, it's much more than the brain.
right.
And so she's into these disease markers, so.
Right, and she looks at kidney function and cardiovascular function.
Right, so it's a hot area, and I think one that, you know, it will have large payoffs. So,
yes.
I'm
hoping. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So I'm just curious about the nutrition piece. I didn't hear much about that, and I'm just curious what you're thinking you might see different in the ones with nutritional supplement versus not.
You know, we don't know. If nutritional supplement improves overall health in general, then it could also affect immune function. But that's one of the goals here, to see whether whatever other outcomes we look at with the nutritional intervention, which Tina has already begun to look at, does it extend to physiological, neuroimmunological function?
I'm just thinking out loud that you know, if that's not as relevant, then maybe you might have more oomph if you look at the variable that, you know, the kid, just the kids without the supplement or just with, but you probably thought about that.
Well, we'll have both, so we'll know, does it matter? And if it doesn't matter in terms of immune function, then we've got a much bigger N in general. But we'll have that power anyway.
Okay.
We will start by looking at both, although we're hoping that possibly we can spill over because there's a new cohort being recruited now without a nutritional intervention. And if we can begin to collect blood from the moms in this new cohort just coming in and in their newborn babies, that will be very powerful as well. But that's,
and
you know, for future possibilities.
I'll just remind you that I think it's important to keep on your timeline because, you know, if this is going to turn into a UO1 type of project, it's going to have to be right on target in terms of your potential to get all this stuff done in the allotted time.
Yes,
all right,
we are. I'll just say, Ed, we're very aware of that. All the paperwork has now gone through. I just emailed Tina for shipment of samples, and they're going to start by sending us a test run of samples, and then hopefully as soon as possible the real samples. So we are on it.
Okay.
Hey, Ed, quick question. Thanks, Joanne, for the update. This might be a question for more so for Tina. But I'm just wondering, with these kids, do we have a record of whether they were breastfed or not and how that might impact their immune system?
Yeah, so at the two-year and four-year follow-up, they're asked about the length of breastfeeding, how long they breastfed, and whether they breastfed or not. And in the poster we presented at RSA, where we're looking at eating habits of the kids, we find that in the alcohol-exposed group, the mothers breastfeed much less frequently, and they breastfeed for a shorter period of time than in the non-alcohol-exposed. So it certainly is a covariate that we want to be able to include in Joanne's project.
And it's Michael. I want to make just a quick comment, and I know we have to move on, but there's a potential relevance of this work to the addiction field also, because one of the mechanisms that is thought to play a role in the effects of adolescent alcohol exposure on brain and on brain systems that regulate behavior is an inflammatory response in the central nervous system.
Right.
It's conceivable that this bias in at least some brain areas to a pro-inflammatory response may at least potentiate the effects of alcohol on neuroimmune damage in adolescents. The potential significance of that is that, you know, as the ABCD study gets started, having measures of cytokines at entry to the study might identify people who, upon exposure to alcohol during adolescence, have a greater probability of showing some changes in structural imaging over the course of the 10 years that they're going to be observed. So I think that apart from the obvious concern to immune function as these kids get older, there's the potential that this feeds into the predisposition for them to develop alcohol and other substance use disorders.
Absolutely, and if there is an interest in measuring cytokines, we could do that.
I'm going to have to move on so that
okay.
I don't, Kirsty.
Maybe we should have this discussion offline.
All the way in from South Africa, and I don't want to keep her up later than she needs to be up.
Okay.
So Kirsty Donald is a professor, a pediatric neurologist, and has done a considerable amount of work on brain imaging and in neonates, which I think is pretty interesting. So, Kirsty, can you take over the screen? And
sure. It's not earlier when I was testing it with Jill, it was fine, but I'm not seeing the shared screen option come up on my screen at the moment. Jill, I don't know if you can help me.
Did you click the quick start tab on the left?
Do quick start, yes. Quick start on the left.
Okay.
On top.
All right. Okie dokie.
There you go.
There's a small, there may be a small delay for you, because there was for me earlier. I don't know, can you see me? Can you see
there
my screen?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I took your letter word, and I'm giving you a very brief overview of what we're doing. So maybe let me just start by saying thank you again for including me in Interfaith. It's such a very exciting project, and I think that really the future of working out mechanisms and interventions and outcomes has to be through these big groups. So coming from across the world, it's to have South Africa back in the collaboration. So our particular project is entitled Neuro and 3D Facial Imaging Study of Tunable Children with Alcohol Exposure Compared to Healthy Unexposed Controls, Embedded in a Cohort Study. So to give a bit of background of where we come from, this study is embedded in a large birth cohort study, which is based in a peri-urban region around Cape Town, where alcohol exposure or alcohol use amongst the community and certainly amongst pregnant women as well is high. And we have recruited the mother-infant pairs antenatally with questionnaires, and we've imaged them. We've done MRI on a 3T semen allegra at 2 to 4 weeks of age, and included in that sequence were structural imaging, DTI, in fact MRS, as well as resting state. We have in total imaged 250 neonates now, and this forms the basis of the group that we will be following it up on in the two-year study. So really, in terms of background, as all of you know, the complexity of the brain's structural and functional networks increase rapidly in the early months of life. It represents a period of rapid acquisition of abilities across motor, sensory, and cognitive areas. And the brain is particularly vulnerable during this developmental window to prenatal environmental influences, and these may have long-term effects on its structure and function. However, in terms of neuroimaging and in terms of what we are, what data is available on the specific effects of alcohol exposure on the establishment of the developmental and the developmental trajectory of the structural and functional development and connectivity in early infancy is very limited. So this is the gap that we are hoping to address. So what are the specific objectives or specific aims of this branch of the study or this sub-study? What we are hoping to do is answer the following two questions to an extent. Can non-invasive neuroimaging identify FASD-related brain abnormalities in early life before symptoms of FASD are diagnosed? And to an extent, we are asking that question at the neonatal period, but we want to be able to know what are the key things that follow through and translate into significant functional deficits at a later stage. And then what are the longitudinal effects of alcohol exposure on the developing brain structure and function in children from birth through early childhood, where there is a big gap in what we know? This is just a picture to give you an idea of the kind of environment where most of the families are coming from. And then just some more nitty-gritty about our methods. So we'll continue to image the children on the same scanner for the moment. It's, as I said, it's a 3T allegra semen scanner. And for this sub-study, we're collecting structural DTI and resting state functional MRI, as well as 3D facial photographs of these children, the same children who were imaged as neonates at 2. With the aim of doing approximately 50 in each group on this project. I've described the umbrella study that this is part of. And then the last thing to say is that because this is a large study which has a lot of, its main focus is child health, there are a lot of other aspects which we haven't had to include in the funding of this particular sub-study, which we will have access to look at. So, for example, the children have formal developmental testing at age 6 months, and I have that again at age 2. They have the Bayley's scales of infant development 3 at 6 months, and at age 2 years, they are, and they have a behavioral assessment. They have multiple biological measures of other exposures that are important and that aren't always reported in imaging studies, things like cotinine measurements for smoking exposure. And in fact, we also have this particular group of children being genotyped at the moment as well. So there's a huge amount of potential about drawing in this other sort of this other population of children into a broader, more global look at the brain development of children with fetal alcohol exposure. So this is really a reminder of the fact that we're wanting to get in there early in terms of identifying children, because that's our window where we can intervene most effectively. And if you want to come visit, that's what it looks like. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. And I know you and I have talked about the facial imaging part of this and the involvement of Peter Hammond and Mike Suddy in that. So just to, I just wanted to bring that out, that that's also an important component of this.
Absolutely.
You know, along with some of the people at USC or UCLA.
Yeah, I'm curious, so this cohort, did you identify them for high and low exposure to alcohol? Like, is there anything in the middle, or is it all very highly exposed versus not?
No, in fact, they identified with the World Health Organization a first questionnaire in the first instance, which basically just screens them in. And then we ask a very, so at birth, we then ask a much more specific questionnaire, which asks about when they, so the trimester that they drank in, as well as the frequency and the quantity that they drank. So we have included in the group children who have moderate or severe alcohol exposure during at least one of the trimesters, and most of them, it's in the first trimester, but they are a significant group, probably about 25% to 30% who continue to drink through pregnancy.
So when you decide who to do the imaging on of those 200, who are you going to choose?
So the 250 is, so the umbrella cohort actually has 1,100 children in mother infant pet net. And they're being followed from the antenatal period through to age 5. This sub-study has imaged 250, of whom 70 have moderate to severe alcohol exposure, and the others do not. Some of them have other issues, so we wouldn't include them as part of our, you know, they wouldn't be clean control, so we would keep them separately. But we have probably I would say about 85 of those are clean controlled, which means that there will be fallout in between birth and two. So some people move out of the area, you know the story. Some people you can't get hold of them, some people terminate their involvement in the study. But there's a very, because it's quite a stable community, and because the umbrella study has a very, active retention strategy, we haven't lost many to date. Now, I mean, I'm still imaging the net as I start with the 2-year-old. So this extends over 2.5 years, really.
So I'm like really, really, really curious to hear and talk to you about how you get the 2-year-old to do it. Because that's really...
How you get...
I can say that
I've read several of her papers. It's amazing that they get the neonates to do this. I mean...
Well, neonates are easy, but 2-year-olds... You don't sedate them, do you? Well,
No, we don't sedate them. But once you don't go to sleep, we do, we sometimes give them a small dose of melatonin, but that's not sedation. It's just sleep initiation. And we don't always get the scan. So I've actually started imaging the 2-year-olds, and we've imaged 10 so far, and successful scans on 8. But we don't always get all of the imaging on one sitting. So I do it at night when they would normally go to sleep. So we go and fetch them from their homes with their mums in the late afternoon and bring them to the imaging center, and we give them a hot meal and then tuck them up with a blanket with them in a darkened room. And we're not finding it's a problem to get them to sleep. And then we pack them very, very tightly into the scanner so that there is, it's obviously quite good noise attenuation. And I sit in them, in the scanner with them.
Okay. I want to move this along. Thank you very much, to Joanne and Kirsty, for bringing us up to date on this. But, there are a few other items we need to try to cover in the next 10 minutes. So, Sarah, you had some thing you wanted to bring up about the Google Doc updates?
Sure, just a minor point. So since we switched our call, when we do our updates doesn't quite coincide. From my perspective, it makes sense for us to continue to do them as we were doing them, which is to update them at the end of the month because it coincides with... what our monthly goals are, so to complete things at the, you know, a certain number by the end of the month, when we routinely do our bulk of our uploads, and when we get our feedback in terms of what has been uploaded from the central repository. So if it's all right with everybody, we're going to continue to do it as we were doing it, so I don't think you'll notice the difference.
No, I don't. It's not going to impact more than one or two subjects probably. At all. And,
right. So just, but like for this month, for example, because we're in the middle of the month, we didn't do an update. So next month, the August line will be changed to reflect the actual August numbers.
Okay. Jill, you have any comments? You have.
We can talk about some.
All right, because you had some updating progress reports. But I think we're good on that.
I thought you meant about that issue.
Nope. All right. We have the Data Access Committee and a final data sharing plan, I believe, which is now going to be implemented. Bill?
That's correct. So the things that we have up now are we have the – I'm going to that page just to make sure.
Do you want a WebEx present or just talk?
Yeah, I can share the screen real quick. Let me do that.
Okay.
So I'm on the data sharing page now at the CFAS site. You guys can all see my screen?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So if you see over here, there's the data sharing policy is done. It's been all approved by the committee, and people can access it here. And then the next is the data access request form is now completed that people can fill out. And when they hit submit down here at the bottom, that form will go into a Google spreadsheet, but it will also automatically generate a notification to the address dac@cfas.org, which is my email address. So it will come directly to me. And then it's my responsibility to get those request forms, those data to the committee for review. And that's what we indeed have established as the process right now, is that these are reviewed by the Data Access Committee. If you want to change that, we can, but that seemed to be what the committee, what you all folks wanted. And then the last piece here is the data use agreement, which will be signed by the institutional representative as well as by the qualifying PI to as part of their agreement to take proper care of the data. And one of the last things we did in terms of this policy was to ensure that as part of the policy that a set of the data were going to be archived with the informatics core, and we're happy to help with that. I think that was really the last tweak to that policy that got put in place. So, and you can see here we already have all the data that are available for folks and descriptions of those data that the folks who own those data have kindly provided. So I think we're in a place where we can start advertising this. We don't have a text that would go out that describes what it is we're sharing, how to share it, where to go, and what to do next. And I believe there were some suggestions about where this communication might go. So I think those are really the next steps for us, is just drafting that language and then getting it out to just try to market this a little bit more broadly.
Yeah, I think it's just the marketing plan now, and if the committee can start working on ways to do that, I think we will be in great shape. I think you all should be congratulated. You did a really nice job on putting this together. And this will usurp any other agreements that have been made, and this is our new plan and the one that we are all going to abide by for sharing data. It meets our NIH requirement, I think, very well. And I think everybody who worked on this bill deserves a round of applause for getting this up and done. So hopefully people will utilize it. Yay!
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
So we'll work on that language and then the communication plan next.
Yeah. We just have to kind of figure out, you know, it's the FASD study group, RSA perhaps, and past project people, NeuroDevNet, and go from there.
Yeah, so with NeuroDevNet, I guess I'll have to talk to them about how this, you know, because you're saying this takes over anything we've done in the past, is that, or do you think that's not true for the NeuroDevNet?
I think it has to. I think it's going to have to be the policy that we abide by. I don't see any issues that NeuroDevNet would have any problems. I mean, they're well established there. So
that'll
work. But I think it's better to have this policy in place than just kind of trying to share data in a more random fashion or so. You know, everybody will know what's going on. We can show NIH what's happening with the data. Bill, do you have any comments on that? Or?
Well, I mean, it's a requirement for everyone's notice of award to abide by the policy. And you're right. I mean, NIH wants to make the data that we help fund accessible to everyone. So,
can I ask one question? Is, I know with like the Ping data sharing, you can go in and see what all projects people have proposed. And I don't know if we're going to have something like that. So you can scroll through and see what other people are proposing to do with the data. I think it's kind of good because you'll sort of know if you're behind the game if someone else is already working on it. Does that make sense?
We can either send out an email to people when a data request comes in, so they know what it's for. Bill, do you have any ideas about that?
Yes. So it'll go to the data. It'll go to the data access committee, who will review it. I know that it will also need to be reviewed by any PIs that are providing data. So I think that everybody who's implicated by sharing of data that's relevant to their project will be informed before any access is granted. So I think that first pass we've got it covered. Everything will be up in a Google spreadsheet that we can share, and at the appropriate period, if you'd like to kind of review those access requests as a greater consortium, you know, we can do that too.
Well, I'm saying that there's a log that anyone who's requesting data can see what other projects have been approved or whatever. So like a log that people logging in to try to access data can see what others have done.
So I think it's easy enough to put up a list of approved projects, and that's part of the data use agreement is they allow us to put data up about their, to publish data about their project as part of the agreement. So we'll be posting those online as well,
All right. Are there any updates on projects that people want to mention?
Well, I know that Shantanu Joshi got his notice of award for his K-25, so we're going to start figuring out what we're doing, and we'll be contacting Peter to see how we can mesh, and so we're kind of excited.
Okay. Any other data-driven ideas? Any comments from the SAB?
Hi, this is John. I'm sorry I was late coming in. I've caught most of it. I did see they're the draft progress reports. Did you talk about that at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jill was supposed to put in that email that, by the middle of September would be fine. There's no rush on those things. It's just to kind of, as we move forward in trying to figure out what we're going to do with CFAS-5, because decisions are going to have to be made in a timely fashion, that the SAB could see, relative to each specific aim that people propose, what has been accomplished to date. And like I did mention at the beginning that people went into a lot more detail than I really needed them to do. But I think the SAB and NIH will get a good idea of how each of the aims has been addressed, where a PI is in relationship to those aims. But if you can look them over, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, then we will have we'll have a conference call to discuss them.
Okay.
All righty. And any written comments, the SAB can certainly get back to me about for those. Bill?
Nothing here from NIH.
Everything is good there, huh?
Sure so.
Okay. Michael?
Nothing new from here. I made my comment already. I'm happy to see both new studies as part of CFAS.
Yeah, me too. And hopefully we'll get some more of the developmental projects after we get a carryover request in and hopefully approved. So that's it from here.
Hey, this is Elizabeth. Michael and Joanne, can we talk about the cytokine thing for ABCD?
I'd love to.
I mean, if I'm fortunate enough to be part of it, I'm happy to sort of mediate with my group about that. So, but I don't have any idea of how to do it. So,
can we do a separate call?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just saying I want to follow up on that.
That would be great. Let's email and set a time to talk.
Okay.
And Ed, this is Kathy. Yep. Can I make a brief announcement?
I'm sorry, Kathy. I wanted to make. Yeah, please do. All right.
Okay. Well, I don't know if everyone knows that we are working on getting September recognized as FASD month and be listed in the healthfinder.org. So that should occur after we actually have to have a month. We have a web page that talks about FASD month, and we're going to be asking a lot of you to do a variety of things throughout this month. And one of the things we want to invite you to do, if anyone would like to be included in a video we're creating, we would like to get photos of you at sites across the world doing some of the work that you do, and possibly a short video that you can just, tape yourself with a selfie of stating your name, maybe
10 seconds to 30 seconds tops, stating your name and what your research is all about, what part of the world that the research is taking place, and then some sort of comment about why NOFAS is important to keep around. And that will be used at the gala on September 17th. So even if you're not at the gala, we'd like to at least be able to feature your research and your beautiful faces in our video. And one last thing, we have launched a stigma campaign, a stamp out stigma campaign, and we're asking for something similar for you to take selfies and maybe hold up something that says like, I'm Dr. Ken Jones, I'm Dr. Ed Riley, and I join the effort to stamp out stigma. And I will send all this information to Jill so you'll know how to upload the videos or send any photos that you may have. And if you have any other questions, you can contact me. Thank you.
And I also wanted to remember mention that the gala is coming up, and you know, we ask people to help support NOFAS, and if you haven't done that yet, Claire Coles is moderating that. So if you would like to make a donation, I would talk to Claire about the gala.
Could you just elaborate on the gala a little bit, Ed? I haven't heard.
Oh, it's the NOFAS Gala. It's an annual event that they have. It's going to be held at the French Embassy this year. And it's their major fundraising event. You could go to the NOFAS website to read more about it.
And Ed?
Be there. Yeah.
It's an international gala, and the hope is to have a CFAS table. And so we're featuring the work, research going on around the world. So certainly if anyone is able to join us, we certainly will recognize your efforts and acknowledge that they're there. And again, it's September 17th in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Okay. All righty, everybody. Thank you very much. And we're right on time. And so unless there's any other last-minute business, we'll talk next month. I'll see some of you in Spain. And everyone travel safe.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
All right. Bye. Bye.